This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. It is a Monday morning, the 29th of May, and here is what we've got for you today. Going to kick off with some of our big business stories today, including the new debt deal in the United States. We'll hear from Joe Biden and reaction from the economist Dan Richards. What else have we got for you? Cracking interview with the entrepreneur Amberine Moussa. She's the founder of Souq Al Mal, talking about her new feature, her new app that she's launching. Talking transportation with Vitaly Bielski of Frost & Sullivan, the consultancy. The RTA in Dubai has said that it wants to be net zero by 2050. It's an ambitious target. He's been talking us through how they might achieve that in the short, medium and long term. Next, we're going to be talking about the economics of cricket. It is IPL final day, Indian Premier League final day. So we've been crossing live to India with the journalist Chandrish Narayanan on the day that, after a rain delay, we hope the IPL final will finally happen. And, of course, talking business, that $6 billion TV deal that the IPL has done. Finally, going to wrap up with Robin Fisher of Salesforce.com. He's been talking to Brandy about why, finally, they are opening a Middle East headquarters. It's in Dubai Internet City, and they want 200 people here. All that to come. First up, though, let's jump right into those top stories.
You're listening to the Business Breakfast, where we've been keeping an eye on an agreement that's been reached in the US. Let's make a deal. I'm not sure if there's much love across the aisle in the US, but a deal and a compromise has been reached, according to those involved.
We've got good news. We've got just spoke with Speaker McCarthy, and we've reached a bipartisan budget agreement that we're ready to move to the full Congress.
This is the standoff over the debt ceiling, whether the US will be able to pay its bills and borrow any more money to keep government running. It's not the first time we have been there, and to get to some kind of initial deal, because it still needs to make it through a vote, people have had to give a little bit.
It takes the threat of catastrophic default off the table, protects our hard-earned and historic economic recovery. And the agreement also represents a compromise, which means no one got everything they want.
No one got everything they wanted. We've been looking this morning at what it means for us, as well as what it means for Republicans, Democrats and Americans in general, with Daniel Richards. He's a senior economist at Emirates NBD. We asked him what we knew at the moment about what was actually in the deal.
The in-principle agreement was reached on Saturday night and will see the debt limit for the US of $31.4 trillion raised for 2 years, but it will include caps on government spending in the period, which does extend until after the next election. Now, as you'd expect, after weeks of negotiation like this, there were compromises on both sides, with the Democrats compromising on a Republican demand to increase work requirements for recipients of the food stamps welfare program. But there were carve-outs for the homeless and veterans secured by the Democrats. Non-defense spending will rise by 1% in 2025 after staying roughly flat next year, while Republicans had pushed for deeper cuts. Now, the assumption by many was always that eventually there would be some compromise way forward reach. But the closer it gets to the wire, you start to wonder if something could go wrong. And that is the way that markets have been behaving over the past several weeks, with risk assets under pressure. Now, with a deal in sight, although it's worth mentioning, it still has to be passed by Congress, so it's not done just yet. But there does seem to be a relief rally already in play, with equities pushing higher.
Yeah, Asian stocks are up this morning. Oil's up as well. We are at about $77.50 a barrel. So we asked Daniel the million dirham question, what does it mean for us?
For the local region, that will be seen most acutely in the oil markets, I'd expect. The debt ceiling concerns are one of the key factors weighing on sentiment in oil prices in recent weeks, But as they have faded, oil has picked up and both benchmarks are up by around 1% so far this morning.
Yeah, we have had that bounce.
So McCarthy and Biden have agreed a deal and they seem to get on quite well. Biden's been saying nice things about him negotiating in good faith. But it's not just a division between Democrats and Republicans. Even within those parties, there are divisions. For example, within the Republican Party, many people oppose the deal. Now, I don't know who these people are, but I like the quotes and it gives you a sense of just how tricky the economics are. For example, there's a Republican from Virginia called Bob Good. Never heard of him? Fine. He is against the deal. He says no one claiming to be a conservative could justify a yes vote for this. But another Republican from South Devoca, Dusty Johnson, is in favour of the deal. But this is what he told CNN about the opposition in the party. Remember, Bob Good's the guy who opposes the deal. Let's be honest. Bob Good will not vote for this thing. And it doesn't matter if Mother Teresa came back from the dead and called him. He's not voting for it and he was never going to. That's what you're dealing with.
Look, let's be fair, the odds on that are low, aren't they?
Exactly. Exactly. But is that level of passion and division, not just between different sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, but within the parties as well. You know, with the Business Breakfast, we look at the economics, but there is a backstory.
Does it need change, though? I mean, are we talking sort of reform here? If every single time we go down to the wire, there's this brinksmanship, it's used for horse trading. I mean, it's not particularly great for credibility for the US, is it?
It's not, not at all. And there have been 60 or 70 of these things over the years, since the 1960s, these debt ceiling standoffs. And yeah, if you're the opposition party, exactly, your phrase is correct. Horse trading. And it should be about the economics, but it's not. It's about the politics.
But to be doing this at a time when you have people talking about a shift away from the dollar as sort of the default global currency, if you like, questions about whether or not the US is still the superpower it's always been, the rise of China, if you like, in influence. Would you argue that it's more damaging at the moment?
It potentially is. And you know, Republicans will say, if we borrow more money, who's buying the US treasuries? Often it's either the Chinese government or Chinese companies, because the US is still the default currency. And that's what you buy. You buy US treasuries. So the argument against raising the debt ceiling is we just become more indebted to China. Again, it's an oversimplification, but these things often are.
Not the only final tonight. It's also the final of Succession. It's already been the final of Succession in the US. So some of us in the studio are very carefully avoiding spoilers before it's broadcast everywhere else this evening. Who takes the mantle of Waystar is the question.
That's it though, isn't it? It's done.
And that is absolutely it. They've killed off the main character. I don't think that's a spoiler anymore. That was four or five episodes ago. That was a massive shocker. If you haven't been watching Succession, we're going to call it a business story, A, because it's been a massively successful television show, but also because it is about infighting in a family company.
And we know that Sheikh Mohammed had to set up a special tribunal after Majid Al-Futtaim died. So these things do happen here.
It has not been, that has not been a plot line in the Succession series that's showing on HBO and other streaming services. But it does raise an awful lot of questions about how you pass a company down from one generation to the next, particularly if you have a massive personality and a massive figurehead at the top. Speaking of huge personalities and figureheads in the business community, very sad weekend for the UAE business community, because we lost one of the first big expat traders and someone who very much has been part of Dubai's evolution economically.
Mickey Jagtiani died over the weekend at the age of 71 after a long battle with illness. His wife, Ranuka, has been the figurehead of that business for many, many years now. I mean, I've met some of his children and they're carrying the mantle forward. But yeah, sad news, Mickey Jagtiani, tributes paid from everyone from Dubai Crown Prince Sheikh Hamdan, who called him an integral part of the Dubai success story.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
When we're talking about getting your ducks in a row financially. While we're young, dumb, young, young, dumb and broke, young, One woman who wants to make sure that we don't leave Dubai a little bit older but still broke is Amberine Musa. She is the founder and CEO of Souq Al-Mal, and she's got a new financial offering. It is called Yabby, and her mission this time is to bring financial literacy into the workplace. Amberine, it's lovely to see you again. Thanks for joining us.
It is. Always happy to be here.
So you're describing Yabby as a masterclass of personal finance. Give us the elevator pitch.
Absolutely. So I do call it the masterclass of personal finance. It is a mobile app that you can learn about anything related to personal finance, all the way from budgeting to how to allocate your assets at 25 and how to allocate your assets at 60, how to invest in art, how to invest in crypto. There are ranges of classes. And what's amazing about it is we add two new classes every single month. So you never get bored, and there's always new places to go and new things to learn.
Why have you done this?
Very interesting question. So last year, as you remember, Souq Al-Mal got acquired by Shoa Capital in May 2022. And at the back of that, there was a lot of, during the last year of Souq Al-Mal, during COVID specifically, they had CEOs calling me and asking me, hey, Amberine, you guys are known for financial education. You've got a lot of stuff out there. I've just dropped salary by 20 to 30%. And what we're finding is we're losing people for 1,000 dirhams extra outside. People are not productive that much anymore because half the time of figuring out how to have a side hustle and how to manage a fund. But more importantly, people were taking kids out of school. And a lot of the employers were, the CEOs were, we've got to do something about this because retention has become a real problem. And so they asked me, do you have anything? And I was like, well, Souq Al-Mal has loads of information, content and articles. And they went, no, we want something structured for our employees, which we can deliver to them. And that's how, you know, the lighting bulb turns up. And we did an MVP last year called The Money Doctor, and that upgraded to Yabby by Souq Al-Mal this year.
Right. So the answer being that you think employees in the UAE need financial education.
I think everybody in the UAE needs financial education. And I think through employees, because the employers are ready to go out there and financial wellness has become utmost important and related to mental health.
And this is a product that you are pushing out through employers. Talk us through the business model.
Absolutely. So it's a subscription model, and employers would come to us or we'd go to them and say, look, part of our financial wellness program going forward is to bring part of our wellness program in general. You've got mental, and now they've added financial health. And the reason they've added financial health to it, because financial health and mental health has a direct correlation with each other. So we would give them a subscription model for anyone below 70 employees. It's 10,000 dirhams flat fee per year. And for anybody above 70 employees, it's around 10 dirhams a month per employee. So it is really not that much. And we've made it a price where it's available and it's accessible for everybody.
To play devil's advocate, would employee financial health not be better served by pay rises and bonuses?
No. And that's a very interesting question, Brandy, because it is not about how much you earn. What it is about is how do you manage whatever amount you earn. 30% should go to your rent maximum. That's 30% of anything you earn. One of our employers that we spoke to, and I'm not going to mention them, which was interesting because the answer to me was, it's okay, we pay a lot, that's fine. And I said, well, it's not about how much they actually earn. And the answer was, well, we work them so hard anyway, they don't have time to spend. And it was a bit of a laugh to me, but there are different ideas of thought processes out there. But again, I keep saying it's not about how much you earn. It is about how much you manage and how much you spend and how much you budget and you save and you invest.
So I downloaded Yabby and had a bit of a play with it this weekend. Entered my goals, you know, top three things that I want to be saving for, how I'm going on, what my credit score looks like. And you've said that employers will be able to understand better an employee's financial needs and their goals. But I am not sure that I would want my employer to know the state of my financial health. Where does privacy come into this?
Absolutely. So the employer cannot anything individually. What we give them is we give them aggregated data. For example, 60% of your employees have those top three goals. What that leads to suddenly is, okay, so if owning a home is one of my top goals of my employees, let me see what I can do, a partnership with a bank, to bring a better rate to the table for my employees. So suddenly benefits to your employees become very different because you're now actually accessing benefits or bringing benefits to employees that they actually care about. You're trying to solve an issue or a need that they have.
People are busy, though. I mean, I can see that this is in my best interest. I could see a couple of courses that I would absolutely love to watch the videos about. How do you encourage people, though, who are already time-stretched, time-poor, to take the time to do this? The company might be paying for it, but how do you actually get people to use it?
Fantastic question. I think if you've gone through the little the courses that we have, everything is broken down. A course is maximum 25 minutes, not more. And everything is broken down into 2 to 3 minutes, and we allow you to do it, whether you can view the course with someone speaking to you, or you can even move it into the car on your drive out. You can just do the audio version of it. We do have a little bit carrots here and there. If within the first 2 weeks of you doing the course and you do your credit score check, we actually give you a free half an hour with a financial coach. I think it's all about changing habits and little bits every day. And we have a whole engagement program for our employees. Little bits every day, 2 minutes here, 3 minutes there, 4 minutes there. You start seeing the outcome of it. But more importantly, in 2 weeks, there's a new feature of the app coming out, which allows you to analyze all your spend and track your spends and analyze your trend in the last 6 months as long as you upload your statements.
And again, there is a lot of data in there in an app that my company is paying for. What are you putting in place firewalls-wise to protect that data?
Well, one thing you have to remember is when you, as Brandy, download the app, your company doesn't have access to any of that. It is on your phone. It's like any other app you've downloaded. So it's got nothing to do with the company's systems.
But even just in general, from hackers, from those who might have...
Oh, no. So it's very secure. We use AWS. We use all the security layers we are required to use. And remember, when I talk about the budgeting app, which allows you to upload your bank statements or connect with your email and easily upload them automatically, we're not connecting to any of your bank accounts. We're not asking you for any passwords. And the reason we're not doing this is because open banking, unfortunately, is still not a thing in the UAE.
Richard had a really interesting point earlier, wondering about what this says about where we are in the move away from the gratuity system.
Yeah, so DIFC has introduced, as we know, 2-3 years ago, the system they call DUES, the DIFC Employee Workplace Savings Plan. Essentially, replacing the gratuity system with something a bit more akin to, say, a 401k in the United States, where your employer pays into a savings plan for you. And it's a fund, and it might do well, it might not do well. It could be invested in the US stock market, Chinese stock market, whatever. And it just struck me that what you're doing now is part of employers wanting to be the employer of choice, doing a bit more for the financial well-being and savings of their employees. Is this part of a bigger trend?
I think it's part of an absolutely bigger trend. There's been surveys coming out from Abu Dhabi where employees do ask now for financial help. I think around 87% of the youth of Abu Dhabi thought planning and budgeting is important and we need help. And what they also found, I think, in the senior citizens, around, I think, 80% were not even planned for the future. And I think we have to remember, as expatriates as well in this country, which is 90% of the population, we don't have a pension fund, right? We do need to plan for the future. And I always say, what is that number? So I ask around the table every single time, what's your number? And 90% of people do not know the number they need to retire on.
Well, thanks so much for talking us through that this morning. Amberie Moussa, founder and CEO of Souq Al Mal, which she founded over a decade ago, now back with her second startup. It's a financial literacy offering. Yabby, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Brandy.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Talking transport now, because the RTA here in Dubai says it wants public transport to be net zero by 2050. Joining us in the studio now is a friend of the Business Breakfast, the transport expert from Frost and Sullivan Dubai, Vitaly Bielski. Vitaly, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. My pleasure.
What do you make of this strategy?
Well, it's hard to say because the horizon is that long. We're looking at 2050, but obviously if you look at RTA's responsibilities and their mandates, they need to align their strategies with the UAE net zero strategy 2050. So it makes perfect sense from the long-term planning horizon. But again, if we look at 2030, 2040, I believe that those plans might need to change in the future.
So you've got comments from Mata Altaya, the Director General of the RTA, saying the new strategy outlines a comprehensive approach to sustainability. And looking at the timeline, the RTA will convert 10% of public buses into electric or hydrogen vehicles by 2030. That's about, 7 years from now. That seems realistic.
Exactly. I would use the same word. I'd also point out that it's the public transportation is not the only goal. It's just one of the 10 themes which RTA is looking at over the next 20-something years. They will be also looking at their buildings. They will be looking at the ways. So it's a very comprehensive plan which is centered on RTA's operations. Public transportation is just one of the things, but it is realistic. It's attainable. It's feasible. So that makes perfect sense because we know that some of the cities or countries, they like to set up over-ambitious goals which are difficult to reach, right? Here we're looking at goals which are relatively realistic, and that makes sense from the feasibility standpoint. But at the same time, if you look at other cities, at other countries, there are more ambitious goals. If you look for London, for example, London is planning to make their public buses electric by 2035. So that means 100% of their fleet electric by 2035. If you look at the New York State in the US, they're planning to make their school buses electric by 2034. So that's okay. That's more ambitious than what RTA is thinking about.
We had a number of questions in about this last week when we were talking about the issue and when Tesla reduced the price of some of its cars. And one of the questions was, are electric cars really that green? Someone wrote in saying, well, they still use energy, which is often produced by fossil fuels. Are they really that much greener? And the other question we had was about batteries, which use a lot of minerals to produce the batteries. What do you say to our listeners who've been questioning the green credentials of electric vehicles?
Well, I would say it's a decade-long question. And the same question was asked about 10 years ago when electric vehicles were just picking up in the market. Whichever way you look at electric vehicles, they're still greener than your conventional internal combustion engine vehicles. The challenge is, are they zero emissions? Are they really zero emissions? And they're not, because if you look at the well-to-wheel emissions, when you look at the well-to-wheel concept, when you look at the emissions which are produced when you extract the fuel, when you manufacture batteries, manufacture the vehicle, then your electric vehicles in any scenario are still greener than your conventional vehicles. But it also depends on what country we're talking about. Of course, in Norway, where majority of electricity is produced by green or through green sources, electric vehicles are way greener than your conventional vehicles. In countries which are focusing on coal when producing electricity, the difference is not that significant. But they still are, even in those countries which are focusing on coal almost exclusively. So it's just that the gap between electric vehicles and internal combustion vehicles is not that big in let's say, countries which are producing energy from coal, but it's still there. Electric vehicles are still greener.
I remember being on holiday in Norway last summer and being a geek researching these things because there are so many electric vehicles on the road. And the month before I was there, 92% of all cars sold were either electric or hybrid. But then petrol prices are so high in Norway as well. So that's an incentive as well. But here in the UAE, maybe we don't have those incentives. Petrol prices are relatively low. What was it? We had Craig from Doobie Cars on the show last week saying the fuel fairy turns up in a truck and fills our car up for us for a relatively low price. And there aren't tax incentives or tax breaks to buy an electric vehicle as you would get in Wyoming or wherever it may be.
That's absolutely correct. If you look at other countries which are making electric vehicles part of their long-term sustainability agenda, they are putting significant monetary incentives towards buying electric vehicles, towards motivating customers or drivers to switch electric. Here in Dubai, in the UAE, in GCC in general, there is no such motivations. There is no such incentives. It's relatively cheap to own and maintain and operate non-electric vehicles, your internal combustion engine vehicles. So there is no real motivation to switch to electric at this point. Plus, you get the challenges when it comes to charging your electric vehicles. At the same time, we need to keep in mind that RTA did try to put out those incentives before, but those are not real monetary incentives. So those were, I would say, soft incentives, which didn't really work. But again, it depends on the government's plan, either to make electric vehicles part of the mobility landscape or to let the free market regulate itself. Because once the global market, global industry is ready to supply electric vehicles at affordable prices, once the charging infrastructure is there, we will see that shift.
Final question about charging. Fine, if you live in a villa, you can buy a charger, stick it on your wall and charge your car. Or not, as the case may be, if you George a Tolly. Turn up half an hour late for a meeting because your car's run out of battery. But, joking apart, there are many charging stations in Dubai, but so many of them are used by taxis or limousines that are public transport machines, which is great and it's fine and good luck to them charging. But how do we solve that problem?
So there are several options to that challenge. The first option is we see that the first customers, first drivers, which are going to be switching to electric vehicles are going to be those living in residential or in villas or in townhouses where you can certainly install home chargers, right? That's the most natural, most obvious option. The second option is we also see the industry switching towards fast charging. We're talking about DC charging, the direct current charging. And if 5 years ago, 3 years ago, we were looking at DC, typical conventional DC chargers, 50 kilowatt per hour. Now we have 150 kilowatt hour chargers. We have 350 kilowatt hours chargers. So those are the ones which can charge your vehicle within 10 to 15 minutes from zero to or 20 to 80% of charge. So the more ultra fast chargers we'll see on the streets, the more with the ownership style of electric vehicles will resemble that of internal combustion engines. We can just drive up to the charging station, drive or recharge a car for 10 to 15 minutes and you're good to go.
And we could get Cathy bringing the charger to us potentially.
Exactly.
Look forward to it. Vitaly, thanks very much indeed for your time. That is Vitaly Bielski from Frost & Sullivan. He is director of their mobility practice. The news that the RTA wants public transport in Dubai to be net zero by 2050.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Yeah, let's talk cricket now if we can, because obviously last night we were expecting to see the finale of this year's IPL, but it didn't happen. Why? We'll find out now from the former chief cricket writer of the Times of India and the Indian Express. Currently based in Dubai, he's just published his latest book, in fact, Journey of a Nation, 75 Years of Indian Sports. He's also been the media manager for the ICC, former media manager for the Delhi Daredevils in the IPL, so knows a thing or two about all things cricket. Joining us live from Mumbai is Chandresh Narayanan. Chandresh, great to have you joining us live here on the show. Why no final last night?
Because it was raining cats and dogs, Tom. Good morning, and good morning to all the listeners. It was raining cats and dogs in Ahmedabad. The whole of northwest of India, it's been raining very heavily. In fact, we needed the rains here in Mumbai. It's pretty hot here. I'm sweating, as you can see from my forehead. I think the rains that were needed in Mumbai is happening in Ahmedabad. The worry is the final is going to be replayed today because today is a reserve day. The forecast for today is not too great as well. So let's keep our fingers crossed.
In terms of the changes, the postponement, etc., how much of a problem is that for not just the organisers, but the right holders and otherwise?
It's a problem for everybody. And for the first time, in a long time, we've had fans traveling. For the past 3 years, we've had the pandemic and all the other issues. IPL was not being held in India. It was being held in UAE. Or if it was in India, it was held in one city. For the first time, after about 3 years, we've had this issue. We have had this IPL being played across the country. So a lot of people I know have traveled to Ahmedabad to watch the final. So they've all factored in the fact that it finishes on a Sunday night, they catch a flight Monday morning and then fly back to their work. I don't think anybody's minding the fact that they're missing work on a Monday morning. You know how it is first thing on Monday mornings for most people. So I think that they wouldn't mind that. But for logistically and all the other reasons put together, it's a nightmare to extend everything by a day because it all adds up costs, as you can imagine, because equipment take a cost, hotels, everything. It's fair to say the hospitality industry in Ahmedabad is having a field.
Let's play worst case scenario, if I may, the naysayer. What happens if it rains today? What happens if there is no play possible today?
So if they would try to squeeze in a 5-5 over a side contest because that's the minimum that you require to play a full T20 encounter. If that doesn't happen, they'll try to have a super over. And if that doesn't happen, Gujarat will be declared champion because they finished on top of the points table at the end of the league stage. Not a fair way, not a correct way to find out who's the best team in the tournament, but something's better than nothing.
Can I ask you about MS Dhoni, the captain of the Chennai Super Kings, former captain of India, and one of the superstars of India? I'm looking at his net worth, $127 million, which makes him a business breakfast story. There's talk that this might be his final match. What do you know?
I think with MS Dhoni, only one thing is certain. No one knows what he's going to do. because he's probably the most secretive or most private person that you can imagine. He hardly answers his telephone, and very few people seem to have his number. So I think that it's very difficult to say. But if I were to draw a parallel, World Cup semifinal 2019, it rained that day, and that was his last game, but he announced it a year later. IPL final, it rained yesterday, and it could rain today as well. Who knows, maybe that's a coincidence, or maybe I'm reading too much into it.
Let's talk about $6 billion, if we can, Chandresh. We understand that's the number that is being bandied around about the media rights, not for this cycle of the IPL, but for the next cycle of the IPL. Is that about right?
That's about right. In fact, it started this year. So for the first time, we've had two broadcasters for the IPL in India. One is Jio on digital, and we've got Star Sports on linear television. And together, they've bid the rights for about $6 billion. So, you know, within a 2-kilometer radius in Mumbai, we've had about 100, 150 former cricketers from all over the world doing commentary from the studio in different languages. Hmm. And also we've had commentators on site who are part of the World Feed production of the BCCI. So it's been fantastic. And I think that the networks have also had a field day. I was looking at some numbers about the advertising rates. And Star Sports, which is the linear broadcaster, has actually hiked its rate for the advertising spot for a 10-second slot from about 1.5 million rupees to about 2.4 million rupees just for the playoffs. And similarly, Jio has also hiked its advertising spots. But, you know, everybody expected that digital would take off, but linear television has also held its ground, which tells you that in India, there's still a market for linear television and digital is growing at the same time.
Is it free to air in India or not?
Yes, on television, it's not free to air. It's part of a subscription package as part of a dish television. But on digital, it is free. Hmm. So if you're in India, you just have to do geocinema.com. You get access to the IPL games. So they are willing to take that risk in that sense with the broadcast on digital, where they want more people to join in. And I've seen that it's become very easy for people to just log on to their mobile phones and while they're in a bus or a train or moving in a car or stuff like that, to just watch the match as it is going on.
Chandresh, can't thank you enough. Fingers crossed we get a bit of action a little later on. I'm sure you agree that 23 has been yet another successful year for the IPL. And if there's anyone on this planet that MS Dhoni will pick up the phone to, I'm sure it's you, Chandresh. So if you could just send him a little text message from us all here at Dubai Eye. All the best to MS Dhoni today in whatever choices he makes. But for now, thank you very much indeed for your time, Chandresh Narayanan, the former chief cricket writer of the Times of India and the Indian Express, joining us live from India this morning, where hopefully we'll get a bit of cricket later.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Oh, we are talking to a man about an office. The American CRM giant Salesforce is set to open its first Middle East office in Dubai later this year. Very pleased to be joined by the Salesforce Senior Area Vice President, joining us from Dublin this morning, Robin Fisher. Robin, good morning. Thanks for speaking to us.
Well, good morning, Brandy. It's a pleasure to join you nice and early on a Monday morning.
And we're excited about the news that you are opening up an office here in Dubai, and indeed an office here in the Middle East. The most remarkable thing about this announcement for us, though, isn't that you're opening one, it's that you haven't done already. Why not?
Yeah, I suppose it's better late than never. Salesforce has been very heavily invested in the Middle East for many, many, many years. And we were very close to making the call. Unfortunately, there was a certain pandemic that put that on hold. So we really are delighted to now say that the amazing team that we have is now going to be onshore. We'll be in Dubai Internet City. We'll start relocating some of the people over the beginning of August. And then we'll set up a bigger office that will be opening, doing the ribbon cutting, hoping soon in the new year. So, a little bit late, but I suppose up until now we've been working with an amazing team that has been flying in and out, but we're going to be closer to our customers going forward.
So what's tipped the balance on that? What's made you decide that flying in and out doesn't quite cut it and you need to actually open an office?
Well, we continue to grow massively in the region. And in fact, if we look at Salesforce in terms of its presence across all of the UAE and the greater GCC Middle East, you know, we've now reached that inflection point where it makes sense. It also comes down to the market requirements as well. Not only are we opening up the Dubai office, we're also opening up Hyperforce, which is basically a local data center. So we're doing that in partnership with AWS. You'll be aware that AWS has just launched their local node in the UAE. And in partnership with them, we'll now be bringing our local data center into the region at the end of the year. So the two things are kind of happening together. The inflection point where we know we must be closer to our customers. Many of them have been global, along with this data center. And if we look at it, the data center now allows companies that might be in the more regulated industries, financial services, comms, media, public sector, to be able to leverage Salesforce.
There's pretty fierce competition in the region at the moment for headquarters. Why have you chosen Dubai and not Saudi?
We've chosen Dubai, I think it's more because of the relationship that we have with customers in the region. We have hundreds and hundreds of customers in the region already. You know, funny enough, TCOM is a customer of ours, along with many of the other free zones, along, you know, I heard Fly Dubai earlier, et cetera. So I think for us, it's the logistical hub that Dubai is. Yes, there's a lot of focus on Saudi and NEOM and, you know, Kuwait, et cetera, some of the neighboring countries. But it really is not just about an office in Dubai for Dubai. It's an office in Dubai for the Middle East. And it's the hub that it offers us to be that hub and spoke for the broader region. The other one is, of course, around talent acquisition and retention. Initially, we have an amazing team that we'll be lifting and shifting most of them over to the region. They got their bags packed, they're good to go. And then, of course, we'll be augmenting that with the other people as we continue to grow and invest in the office.
How many people are you actually relocating here?
Well, initially, it's going to be a cohort. I don't have the exact figures at hand. It's safe to say that, funny enough, we have hundreds of people already just dedicated on the Middle East. If we look at sales, pre-sales, delivery capacity. We're not forcing anyone to move over, but we certainly have a long list of people that have put up their hand and volunteered. So it is going to be a phased approach of people being on shore from July, August, all the way through. And as I said, we have a temporary office. The more permanent office will be opening come February once it has been kitted out and we do the ribbon cutting. So yeah, we plan on reaching a point of having a couple of hundred people in the region in the next 5 to 6 years.
And that's the reason that I ask. We've got a bit of a population boom going on here at the moment, so I'm trying to gauge the scope of this office. If you end up with a couple of hundred people, how many jobs are you actually going to create in the region as opposed to the people you're bringing in? Sort of a rough percentage.
Yeah, absolutely. So we do a study called the Salesforce Economy. So, you know, that's just the direct Salesforce investment of creating employment and jobs within the region. If we look at the broader ecosystem, you know, we are planning on having actually thousands and thousands of people being affected. Just a small example might be if we look at our partners that we have, you know, for example, even in just in the DIC where we're going to be located, there's IBM, there's Accenture, there's Publicis. That's just to name a few of the partners that we have. So at the last look, I think we have over 150 partners, from little boutique partners all the way over to the big GSIs using Salesforce in the region. And that downstream effect, you know, means that thousands of people will be using Salesforce directly in terms of consulting. Many of our customers, our large customers, have also set up centers of excellence within their business where people are focusing just on that Salesforce skill. So we anticipate thousands of people actually having a career downstream. Already it is the case. If we look at the number of certified individuals, these are people skilled up on Salesforce, making a living out of Salesforce in the region. That's already in the thousands. You know, they capitalize on a training platform we had called Salesforce Trailhead that helps them become ready for the digital future. The other thing is everyone's talking about it. So, you know, is the GPT. So Salesforce as a CRM company, big focus on artificial intelligence. So we have our own GPT function plus data. You know, data is the new oil, I guess, in terms of technology and the CRM. So we're certainly creating a platform for many, many people to be employed on Salesforce. So the knock-on effect is going to be thousands of people employed. There really are a couple of hundred people for sure employed.
Is it a case of opening a brand new office and creating a couple of hundred more jobs for Salesforce, or are you actually moving an office from somewhere else here? Are we becoming a preferred place to work to somewhere else, I guess is what I'm asking.
It is definitely a bit of both, right? You know, we are a cloud company. We operate and service our cloud customers anywhere in the world. And I think to this point, we've managed to get to this inflection point, Brandy, where, you know, we've been able to service this massive market that the Middle East already is for us. But definitely there's a case of getting closer to the customer and the consumer and our partners. So it's a bit of both. We'll certainly absolutely be moving some of our people over. And, you know, we like to internally joke about keeping that culture, that brain transplant or the tour of duty. But in addition, we absolutely have plans and investment strategies to bring a lot more people and a lot more skills into the market directly as well as indirectly. You know, we have a big independent software community. They'll be getting skilled up. We'll be putting people into our customers as well. So a bit of both. It's lifting and shifting some people who want to be there as well as creating new opportunities within the region.
The Salesforce, though, announced layoffs of about 10% of its workforce earlier this year. That's around 8,000 people. How does that decision fit with this expansion?
Yeah, the optimization of the business came down, I guess, for most technology companies, as you're aware. That was a global requirement after the huge investments of COVID. For us, Middle East is very much fits into what we call the EMEA growth market. So it's absolutely less impacted by any of the reorganization. And you can already see it with the office, with the Hyperforce. This is more an investment region rather than maybe an optimization or reorg region. So yes, with some of the acquisitions we may have made and the optimization, some of our colleagues have been affected. That is behind us. And now it's really focusing on growing, doubling down on our AI data and CRM. So we do see growth rather than stagnation.
Well, as a tech company, as a cloud computing company, will you be bringing work from home practices here to your office in Dubai, or is it going to be an in-the-office policy?
It does tend to be both. You know, I think there is very much a sense of getting that osmosis, that water cooler sentiment by being in the office. But the sentiment of having the office is about getting our employees in with our customers, with our partners. So it's a bit of both. I definitely would advocate that I do want some of the team in the office because they learn from each other, they excel from each other. But more importantly is to be in front of the customer. So we'll be maintaining a hybrid facility.
Thanks so much for joining us this morning. That was Robin Fisher. He's a senior area vice president at Salesforce, a giant tech company that will be opening up a little bit later this year. Its first Middle East office and basing it in Dubai. Interesting to hear the thought process around the decision to move a bunch of employees into the UAE and why the UAE at a time when we know we've got some big competition for headquarters at the moment.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com. You've been listening to a DubaiEye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from DubaiEye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.